Welcome to Reader's Digest on Voice Corps. I'm your volunteer reader, Julie Milligan. For the next half hour, I'll read articles from the February-March 2026 issue of Reader's Digest. We had to stop midway last time reading the article, How Not to Waste 11,849 Human Organs, which is about organ procurement and transplants in the United States. Just to recap briefly, we have a gentleman who was being removed from life support, and there was a 60-minute window in which he would need to pass away in order for them to be able to use his liver for donation, which was awaiting him in Arizona. So he was taken off of life support, and that's where we pick up. 28 minutes in, the heart rate display shows an X, and the respiratory rate display flashes with white letters that spell apnea, which indicates his breathing has stopped. But Brian's heartbeat resumes a few minutes later, and 53 minutes after life support was withdrawn, his heart rate climbs to 132 and then falls back to 93. 2 minutes later, Freeman closes her laptop. Brian isn't going to die in time. Freeman believed that Brian's lungs and kidneys, though not the organs of a young healthy man, could have improved the lives of the right recipients. But every one of her 3,909 offers was shot down. His liver could have helped someone too if circumstances had been different. For the 100 or so other personnel who had mobilized to transplant his liver, staff from the Arizona Mayo Clinic and Mercy San Juan, the contractors who brought a pump to connect to the liver, the lab that ran his tests, the circumstances were out of their control. Minutes after Freeman calls it, the Arizona surgeon is gone, driving to the airport. Freeman's packing up too. She's disappointed, but she has charts to catch up on. Critics agree the supply chain must become more efficient. But here, in the room with Brian Benedem and all the beeping machines, efficiency could be tantamount to murder. Some who read news reports, like NPR's 2024 study, worry that organ procurement officials let patients die so they can retrieve their organs, or that officials will take organs from living patients. In reality, about half of patients like Brian do not die within the time necessary to donate their organs. And all that officials like Freeman can do is wait, watching the clock and the patient's vitals. So officials must manage what they can. The allocation algorithm is an obvious place to start. The DonorNet computer system could be optimized to rapidly allocate at-risk organs before they're too damaged for transplantation, and more precisely match organs to recipients, encouraging surgeons to more often say yes, researchers say. Richard N. Formica, M.D., the former president of OPTN's board of directors, says the group is transitioning to a new model designed to rank waitlisted patients based on multiple factors, other than primarily by how long they've been waiting. These changes are intended to allocate organs based on a more nuanced criteria, theoretically facilitating better matches that surgeons would be more likely to accept. And until the algorithm is improved, transplant centers can filter out DonorNet offers they won't use, allowing coordinators like Freeman to comb lists faster. Eunice has already started implementing this through a tool called Offer Filters, designed to automatically filter out offers that aren't a good match. These changes, of course, are no balm for David and Lisa Benedom. They're devastated that Sierra Donor Services couldn't recover Brian's liver. They know the narrative that's out there. They want people to know that organ donation is safe. I don't want to discourage people from being organ donors, Lisa says. Brian would eventually die 2 days later. His liver, his lungs, and both his kidneys would be cremated with him. Now some points on how to become a donor. Most donated organs, about 80%, don't go to waste. They save thousands of lives every year. Anyone over the age of 18, regardless of medical history, can sign up to be a donor. While you're still alive, you can donate some organs and tissues, including one of your kidneys, part of your liver and lungs, skin and bone, after certain surgeries, and blood, of course. For information on living organ donation, visit organdonor.gov. To become an organ donor after your death, you can register online. Visit registerme.org to add yourself to the National Registry, or use the interactive map tool at organdonor.gov to find your state form. You can sign up in person. Complete your registration during any Department of Motor Vehicles transaction, including renewing your license, registering a vehicle, or registering to vote. You can use your smartphone. If you have an iPhone, you can elect to be a donor in the Health app, which submits your choice to a national computer system. However you sign up, it's important to share your decision to donate with your family. This makes your choice clear, helps prepare your loved ones, and ensures your wishes are carried out as you intended. Now for 13 things. Fast facts about NASCAR. 1. Drivers, start your engines. The annual NASCAR Cup Series kicks off February 15th with the Daytona 500 at Daytona International Speedway in Florida. Considered NASCAR's most prestigious event, the Daytona 500 is often called the Great American Race. First place will pocket an estimated $3 million. 2. To win the Cup Series, a driver must top the standings at the end of the 36-race season. What determines those standings are points, which drivers earn for their position at each stage of each race. Drivers race more than 12,000 miles in total each season. The number in race names indicates the miles, not the laps. That's like going from New York to Los Angeles and back, twice. 3. The National Association for Stock Car Auto Racing, NASCAR for short, was founded in 1947, but its roots trace back to Prohibition. Bootleggers of the 1920s and 30s moved alcohol in cars modified for extra speed so nimble drivers could outrun the police. The winner of the first official NASCAR race, held in Daytona in February 1948, was former booze runner Robert Red Byron. 4. If auto racing hardly seems like a sport to you, consider this. During a race, a driver's heart rate turbos to 170 to 180 beats per minute, right in line with the average marathoner. NASCAR drivers also lose up to 7 pounds of sweat from start to finish, so they use pit stops to wolf down energy gels and bars. 5. Pit stops last an average of 13 to 16 seconds. In that blink of an eye, 5 people from the pit crew refuel the car and change some or all of the tires. The fastest tire changers make a swap in about 4 seconds. You're listening to Reader's Digest on VoiceCorps. My name's Julie Milligan, and I'll continue to read from 13 Things, Fast Facts About NASCAR. We're on number 6. Racetracks vary in size, ranging from the shortest, the quarter-mile oval at Bowman Gray Stadium in North Carolina, to the longest, Road America in Wisconsin, a 4-mile road course with 14 turns. Not every track features in the Cup Series, except stalwarts like Daytona and Indiana's Indianapolis Motor Speedway. But the Indy 500 race that also happens at the Speedway is not a NASCAR event. It's part of the Indy Car Series, which is more like Formula One. 7. Formula One, or F1, features smaller, single-seat cars with open cockpits. These cars go faster than the stock cars of NASCAR, which look more like sedans. Some F1 races take place on city streets, not racetracks. In the United States, NASCAR is the more popular of the two. Globally, F1 has the larger fan base. But F1 has exploded in popularity stateside, thanks in part to the Netflix reality series Formula One: Drive to Survive. ESPN, which broadcasts F1 races, says viewership has doubled since 2018. Number 8. Still, NASCAR is not an exclusively American sport. Races have been held as far away as Australia and Japan. And last June, an official point-paying Cup Series race was held outside the U.S. for the first time, at the Autódromo Hermanos Rodríguez in Mexico City. NASCAR also runs separate series in Mexico, Canada, and Brazil, as well as one in Europe. 9. Women make up about 37% of the NASCAR fan base. In fact, female drivers go bumper to bumper with their male counterparts in NASCAR races. Danica Patrick is perhaps the most famous female driver. She became the first woman to hold the pole position, the front and most favorable position at the start of a race, given to the driver with the fastest qualifying time, in the Daytona 500 in 2013. Though Patrick never won a NASCAR race before she retired in 2018, she still holds the record for the most top 10 finishes by a female driver at 7. Number 10. When three drivers cross the finish line just 0.007 of a second apart at a race in Atlanta in February 2024, two high-speed cameras determined their order. Of course, such technology didn't exist at the first Daytona 500 in 1959. Lee Petty was declared the winner of that race, but not until 61 hours after it ended. A newsreel image developed days after the race proved that Petty had crossed the finish line 2 feet ahead of his competitor, Johnny Beauchamp. Number 11. Lee Petty's son, Richard Petty, is a NASCAR legend in his own right. Affectionately known as the King among fans, Richard is the all-time winningest driver with 200 wins, nearly twice as many victories as David Pearson, who holds second place. On the opposite end of things, J.D. McDuffie has raced 653 times in his nearly 30-year career, beginning in 1963. Yet he never won a race. 12. Even if you've never watched NASCAR, you'd likely still recognize the black and white checkered flag that signals the end of a race. The flagman, who stands above the finish line and essentially controls the race, uses different flags to communicate various messages to the drivers. including white, one lap remaining, green, go, race normally, yellow, reduce speed, race under caution, and red, stop. Yellow and red flags may also be used to indicate dangerous conditions like bad weather, debris on the track, or crashes. Number 13. Auto racing, it must be said, is inherently dangerous. Cars collide regularly, often going 200 miles per hour. Following the 2001 death of driver Dale Earnhardt Sr. from a crash during the final lap of the Daytona 500, NASCAR implemented safety upgrades, such as the HANS device, H-A-N-S, a head restraint designed to protect the neck, and the safer barrier, a cushioned wall that surrounds the track. Thankfully, there have been no driver fatalities in the NASCAR Cup Series since. From the healthy, can I really skip the colonoscopy? For many people, at-home tests may suffice. By Christine Gaspar. My college roommates and I watched Katie Couric make history in 2000 by undergoing a colonoscopy on TV. That memory stuck with me, and more than two decades later, I announced to my doctor that I'd been proactively strategizing for my first one. "Don't worry," I said. "I'm going to take the day off work and spend the afternoon recovering." I was taken aback when he told me I probably wouldn't need to. Not that it wasn't time for me to start screening for colon cancer. In 2018, the American Cancer Society had lowered the recommended age to 45, and in 2021, other organizations followed. But for many people at low risk, me included, thankfully, he said an at-home screening test was all that was needed. So, no prep, no hospital visit, and no anesthesia, unless the home screening showed something. These days, while colonoscopies are still the gold standard, at a growing number of healthcare organizations, they're no longer the first-line diagnostic to screen for the presence of colon cancer. That's a big convenience. It's challenging for many Americans to plan for a day off from work for the procedure, and possibly another for the day before prep, taking laxatives and spending a lot of time in the bathroom to ensure your colon's cleaned out before the colonoscopy, which consists of a tiny lighted video camera traveling through the colon to look for polyps or other signs of cancer. And colonoscopies are right up there with root canals for things people do not want to do. Good news, the prep has evolved, says Patricia Vaccarello, DO, a physician trained in family medicine. It's easier to tolerate and gives a better clean out. But there's still the uncertainty around the insurance coverage for an outpatient procedure that requires anesthesia, which can be a blow to your wallet if it's not covered. For my at-home test, my doctor explained that I'd receive a kit in the mail. I'd collect a stool sample myself and send it back to the company for analysis. If no evidence of cancer was found, I'd be good to go for another year. If you've ever needed a nudge to schedule a routine screening, remember this. There are very few types of cancer for which you can be screened. The Cleveland Clinic reminds us the cancers of the breast, cervix, prostate, and colorectal region are four of the few types that have early detection tests. In 2025, National Cancer Institute data indicated that colorectal cancer is among the top five most diagnosed cancers annually, contributing to nearly 10% of cancer deaths. You're listening to Reader's Digest on VoiceCore. My name's Julie Milligan, and I'm continuing to read from Can I Really Skip the Colonoscopy? Many experts emphasize that early detection often leads to better outcomes, which is important because the disease has been on the rise among some groups. These days, around 10% of diagnoses happen in people younger than 50, mostly among those in their 40s, according to the Mayo Clinic. And the average age of a newly diagnosed colorectal patient is now 67, down from 72 less than 20 years ago. If your doctor determines that in-home screening will work for you, three types of kits are available. The fecal immunochemical test, or FIT, and the less common guaiac-based fecal occult blood test, GFOBT, both check for the presence of blood, which may indicate cancer. The third type, such as Cologuard, checks for evidence of DNA shed by cancer cells in the stool, as well as for blood, and may require a larger specimen. A DNA test is recommended every 3 years if results are normal, while the other types of tests are annual. Nadeem Anwar, MD, Division Director of Gastroenterology at West Virginia University School of Medicine, says these kits can be quite effective. The DNA tests are close to 95% accurate, and the FIT tests around 75%. The guaiac-based tests, which are older, generally have lower accuracy rates, and the American Cancer Society recommends that only the newer, highly sensitive versions be used. However, Dr. Anwar stresses the at-home tests are less than 50% effective at detecting polyps. This is a disadvantage because polyps occur before malignancy develops. This is one reason a colonoscopy is the more thorough route. The scope is more likely to find polyps before cancer is present and can even remove them. So, at-home tests aren't recommended for people who have a personal or family history of colorectal cancer or certain gastrointestinal disorders, such as inflammatory bowel disease. If your at-home test shows possible evidence of cancer, you'll be referred for a colonoscopy. Dr. Vaccarello says some patients will have to cover a greater cost for a colonoscopy that follows an at-home test. So check your insurance and talk to your doctor to determine whether starting with an at-home test makes sense for you. My test kit arrived just days after my 45th birthday. The instructions were simple to follow. Sure, getting up close and personal with the collection container felt weird, but it actually felt like a privilege to grasp steadily onto the test stick, as I considered that this easy 5-second task could help rule out an illness that takes more than 50,000 lives in America each year. Suggestion to test kit makers: include gloves. Some kits do, but mine didn't. Then I packed up the specimen and put it in the prepaid return package. Within a few days, my doctor contacted me with the good news that no evidence of cancer had been detected. To be spared the prep, however gentle, and to not miss a day of work was some relief. So was learning that I was in the clear, at least until my next birthday. Every March for Colorectal Cancer Awareness Month, my team at thehealthy.com interviews Katie Couric, who nearly 30 years after her first husband, Jay Monahan, passed away at age 42, is still an ardent advocate for screenings. As Couric once told us, "My major message is the best test is the one that gets done." From Life in These United States: I was out for a walk in Manhattan when I noticed a man with a tail wagging dog. I love dogs, and I wanted to pet this one, so I asked the man whether his dog was friendly. "Yes," he said, continuing on his way, "but I'm not." From Elizabeth Levine, from the New York Times. I play in a senior softball league. After one game, a teammate and I were taking off our various leg wraps and muttering about how we never used to need those devices. My knees got so bad, I wasn't able to genuflect at Catholic Mass, I said. But after months of exercise and figuring out how to wrap my legs, I'm now able to genuflect without any issue. My friend shrugged. It would have been easier to convert to Lutheranism. From Tim Kinsella of Oakdale, Minnesota. My friend is not the best listener. Case in point, I referred to the old proverb, March comes in like a lion and goes out like a lamb. And he replied, what? Did you not hear what I said, or did you not understand my meaning? I asked. His reply, I didn't hear anything after Tiger. From Susan Bush of Cary, North Carolina. From Laughter the Best Medicine. How do snails fight? They take off their shells and slug it out. Submitted by James Ruma of Lakewood, Colorado. And for my final act, said the Spanish magician, I will make my lovely assistant disappear on the count of three. Uno, dos, and just like that, the assistant disappeared. Wow, said an odd man in the audience. She disappeared without a trace. Submitted by Paul Heath of Kent, Washington. Thanks for listening to Reader's Digest on VoiceCore. Stay tuned for more programming on VoiceCore, your audio access to the world.